From NPR News, you're listening to the best of weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturday and Sunday. This episode, governors are giving their State of the State addresses, and the state of the states isn't good. Also, before he became famous for writing Lolita, Vladimir Nabokov was better known as an expert on butterflies, and it turns out his once-dismissed scientific research has now been confirmed. Plus, 40 years of broken wagon wheels, dysentery, lost oxen, how the computer game Oregon Trail was invented. We'll hear about the strange life of Bobby Fischer from a man who knew him well, the jazz man behind a famous Muppet tune.
Manamana.
Inspires a new jazz record, and the early 20th century poem that's galvanized the masses in Egypt. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. The State of the Union may be over, but the State of the State addresses, those are the ones given by governors each year, have just begun. California's Jerry Brown and Wisconsin's Scott Walker deliver theirs this week, and if you've heard any of the others so far, you might have noticed a theme.
What is the state of the state?
We must not sugarcoat it.
We're in a crisis unmatched.
New Mexico
in the last
is in a
60
state
years of our state.
Of financial
we have to deal
crisis.
With a roughly $1 billion shortfall.
My budget recommends the consolidation.
This will include
eliminating
eight state
agencies. In spending cuts.
This is a time of crisis for our state.
We cannot continue to spend money we don't have.
No more shell games.
No more rosy projections.
We cannot print money, and we cannot run deficits.
This budget year is going to hurt.
Grim sounds from some of the recent State of the State addresses. We heard from the governors of New York, Nevada, New Mexico, Michigan, South Carolina, Kansas, New Jersey, and Colorado. States are bracing for massive budget cuts. In Colorado, for example, the budget gap is more than $1 billion, and many school districts there are already on a four-day week. I asked the governor, John Hickenlooper, to give us a sense of his predicament.
Well, without a question, this is the most serious recession in my lifetime. And most of the people here in the State House are saying they haven't seen anything like this in, you know, in 75 or 100 years.
Now, unlike the federal government, Colorado, like most states, is not allowed to run deficits. It is also very difficult to raise taxes in Colorado. So is your only real option at this point to make cuts that may be drastic?
Well, the fact you're right, the legislature can't increase taxes. It has to go to a vote of the people. And that's, in this economy, certainly unlikely. And what that really means, and certainly for a fact in this legislative session, is the only solution we have is cuts. You can't borrow. You can't put it off till tomorrow. We just need to gather everyone in a circle and say, all right, here are the options. And here are the legitimate consequences. If we cut this much out of higher education, here's how they're going to feel it in classrooms.
You have a close to 9% unemployment rate in Colorado, by no means near the top of the list in the United States, but still obviously significant. Do you think that folks in Colorado have a full understanding of what they are about to encounter over the next year or two?
No, I think most people are hoping that the economy will get better more rapidly than I think it will, hoping that we won't come to that point, which we're already at, that we are going to have to make the cuts. Part of the difficulty is to make sure that we tell that message and explain what the cuts are going to look like, how they'll feel them, what will they see in their daily life.
In a sense, Governor Hickenlooper, are you in a position where, say, the economy does not improve in the next year or two, and you are the guy who signs this budget with these cuts, that you may actually be blamed for cutbacks in state programs?
Well, elected officials get blamed for things all the time that aren't their fault or responsibility. As mayor of Denver, I got blamed for snowstorms. You know, the list is long. I think the key here is to focus people's attention as clearly and rapidly as possible that if you're not going to raise taxes, and these are very difficult cuts, the one thing you can do is to be more pro-business. And because this is Colorado, we want to make sure that we hold ourselves to the highest environmental standards, make sure we protect our land and waters, the highest ethical standards, but we still got to be more pro-business. In my inaugural address, we talked about, in the State of the State speech, how maybe we should have, instead of just as we have an environmental impact statement, maybe we should have a regulatory impact statement. If the legislature is going to impose new regulations on business, let's take the time to examine what the unintended consequences might be, and so that we don't create red tape. And that's part of how I think you get through the budget deficit, is to cut red tape, help each small business hire that extra person.
Governor Hickenlooper, most states pass a new budget each year. The federal government passes a new budget each year. You have talked about building a budget every 2 years. How would that help improve Colorado's fiscal situation?
Well, so many of the challenges we face in the budgeting stem from not sufficient planning. You know, when I ran my restaurants, we would never just do a one-year budget. We always had a three-year budget or a five-year budget, some sort of a planning document that tried to anticipate unexpected costs, be ready for opportunities should they appear. I think the state should be doing the same thing.
That's Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper speaking to me from his office in Denver. Governor, thank you so much.
You bet.
Sue Urans, the managing director at the Pew Center on the States, and she says even before the recession, many economists, including those from the Government Accountability Office, predicted the fiscal nightmare that most states now face.
There are some really significant factors that predate the recession. Mm-hmm. GAO did a report. They looked out over 50 years at what the fiscal situation of the states was going to be. And what they found was over that very long time period, there was going to be a $10 trillion gap that states would face. And a lot of that was because of the increasing cost of health care. The cost of education is going up. What they are obligated to pay for their public employees' pensions and post-retirement benefits, those are fairly significant. So those cost pressures are going up no matter what the states do. And the revenue is just not keeping pace.
What can governors or legislatures do in the various states if they can't, say, raise taxes, for example, because voters have to approve tax hikes, or if they can't run deficits? Is it about cuts at this point?
Really, at this point, given the public has not much appetite for tax increases, you've got at least a dozen new governors who have taken a no new taxes pledge. It's limiting, in many cases, what they can do and will focus them on spending cuts.
So in a state like Colorado, where the legislature essentially has to cut about 15% of its budget, how would the average person in Colorado see that impact in the coming year?
It may be everything from parks may not be open or even part of the public realm anymore. You may find that your driver's license office is only open 3 days a week instead of five, or you have to do it online now. The court system may become far less efficient as there are fewer public employees to staff it. Your class sizes may get larger in the K-12 system. Your college tuition may go up pretty considerably. That's some of the impact I think the public will feel.
Which states are in the deepest trouble financially? Which states will have to sort of overcome the biggest hurdles to get out of their situations?
Well, there are several states that are facing pretty severe stress. I think Illinois has been much in the media of late. They are certainly under a lot of stress. California. You have states like Nevada and in Arizona. Nevada is, you know, the total size of the budget gap may not be big relative to the big states like New York, Illinois, and California, but it's half of their general fund budget.
How much does this present a risk to the full economic recovery that we're all hoping for and expecting?
It is tremendously important for people to understand that the decisions that states make, whether on the spending or the revenue side, do have the potential to impact the national recovery. You cannot make decisions at the state level absent that consideration. So the more that people are able to really understand the intertwined nature of those decisions, I think the better decisions are likely to be made in the long run.
That's Sue Urans. She's managing director at the Pew Center on the States. Sue, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Long before Vladimir Nabokov published his sensation, Lolita, most of his colleagues knew him as an avid collector and researcher of butterflies. And shortly after he emigrated to America in 1940, he landed a job at Harvard as the curator of Lepidoptera at the university's Museum of Comparative Zoology. But on the side and quietly, he'd write prose, of course, but also poetry, including this one about what else? Butterflies.
I found it. And I named it, being versed in taxonomic Latin. Thus became godfather to an insect and its first describer, and I want no other fame.
That's a recording from 1952 of Nabokov reading his poem, A Discovery. Nabokov once said that he might have spent his life hunting butterflies instead of writing books had it not been for the Russian Revolution. And he was particularly interested in a group of South American butterflies known as the Polyomatous Blues. And in 1945, he published his theories about where they might have come from originally.
He believed that they came from ancestors in Southeast Asia that had crossed the Bering Strait, entered down through North America, across the Isthmus of Panama, and then radiated or speciated on the tops of the Andes in South America.
That's Naomi Pierce. She's a professor of biology at Harvard who's been using modern technology to put Nabokov's theory to the test. She says that his research paper on the Polyomatous blues should have made a splash in the scientific community.
But as far as I can see, it sort of died without a trace. It's not a huge community, and there wasn't a lot of note taken of this. But in later revisions of the group and systematic treatments of the group, his ideas were pretty much put to one side.
At the time, he was teaching Russian and also comparative literature, I believe, at Wellesley. Did his colleagues, other entomologists, know this about him, that he was actually hoping to be a writer? Or did they think that he was kind of this kind of crank, or was he taken seriously?
No, there was a terrific interview with Charles Remington, who was a famous entomologist at Yale, who knew Nabokov at the time and said he was absolutely amazed when Lolita was published because he had no idea that this fellow, who he knew as a lepidopterist, had these other ideas. He said he thought he was quite a dignified gentleman, so he was so surprised when he read Lolita.
Why was his theory so radical at the time?
It was radical because he proposed 5 new genera of butterflies. This is a very significant new slice of biodiversity, if you want to put it that way. And also because he had a very specific hypothesis for how it happened. He said they came across the Bering Strait, but then all the North American relatives went extinct. And then there were 4 more invasions across the Bering Strait. And he cites them in turn. He describes a biologist in a Wellesian time machine coming up through the Cenozoic, and he says, first they'll see this group and then the next group. And he's very precise about both the classification of those groups and the timing. And this is very unusual, even in literature at the time, to be so specific, to provide such a complex hypothesis.
He didn't have sophisticated DNA testing equipment back then. So how did he come up with the theory? I mean, what did he do?
All of this was based on his knowledge of the finer features of the genitalia of the males of these butterflies.
Professor Pierce, at the time, these theories were not taken too seriously by his contemporaries. You actually decided to test them out, and remarkably, you found that it's all right, that he was entirely correct. So were you surprised at what you found?
I was astonished. What really surprised me was when I went back and I read the paragraph again talking about the traveler in the Wellesian time machine, and I saw the distinct ordering that he gave for the groups that our time traveler would see as they come up through the Cenozoic era. That's when I was blown away, because he made these 5 predictions and he was spot on correct about all of them.
That's Naomi Pierce. She's a professor of biology and the curator of Lepidoptera at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology. Naomi Pierce, thank you.
Thank you.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the Oregon Trail, not the historic path of Western expansion, but perhaps the most popular educational computer game of all time. Ah, yes, fording the river, changing a broken wagon wheel, dying of dysentery, happy memories for millions of schoolchildren who, since 1971, have spent hours pretending to set off on that 2,000-mile-long journey in the year 1848.
Well, are you ready? Come on, let's go!
The game is now on the iPhone, and next week another version is set to launch on Facebook. Now, the story of how Oregon Trail was created begins in 1971. Don Rarich was teaching junior high in Minneapolis, and he was having trouble getting his students interested in U.S. history. So, with help from his roommates, Paul Dillenberger and Bill Heineman, they invented a basic computer program where kids could pick characters and then trace the Oregon Trail. And Rawich first tested it on those same students on the school's only teletype machine.
It was like the size of an IBM Selectric typewriter, let's say, but on a big pedestal.
And there was no screen, we should say.
No screen. Right. It was all handled by text printing out on paper.
Right.
So that had to be wheeled up, put next to the classroom phone I had, And in those days, you connected a computer to a phone line by taking the handset of the phone and kind of slamming it into a box
right.
that had cups on it. And so that's how we made the connection. I had the kids divide up into small groups so that they could try running the program and rotated them through while one group was on the computer, the other groups were doing other things to prepare.
How did the kids respond to it? Was it a hit right away?
Well, they certainly were excited. They probably didn't get to use the computer that often in school, and here was a chance, and it was something different than the textbook, and it was an opportunity for them to make their own decisions and try to solve a real problem.
We're going to jump forward now 40 years because of the history of what happened with the Oregon Trail is too complex to go into detail here. But essentially, this game became an enormous hit. Still played by kids all over the United States. Some 65 million copies of this game have been sold worldwide. Did you ever imagine it would be this huge?
No, not at all. There wasn't really a consumer market for software in those days because we didn't even have personal computers yet. So I think we were more taken by the fact that we could actually figure out a way to program the computer to do these things, and that was kind of a victory enough.
Well, Don, I could tell you I love playing the game as a kid, and I will make sure that when my kid is old enough to play computer, I will have him play the latest version of Oregon Trail. This is a game where, you know, kids and some adults learn about history and geography, economics, and so on. I wonder what lessons you have learned from making this game.
Well, as I've studied about the Oregon Trail and helped to create the game, I came away with four lessons that I think are pretty valuable in life. Number one, plan ahead. There's danger out there. Number two, be patient. The journey is long. Number three, if you persevere, you'll find your green valley. And number four, even if the water is deep, sometimes you just have to caulk your wagon and head out from shore.
And number five, you end up in Oregon if it all works out, which isn't a bad place to be.
Very cool.
That's Don Rawich. He's one of the creators of the original Oregon Trail computer game. It celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. He joined us from his home in Evanston, Illinois. Don, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
One night in 1960, a chess player named Frank Brady sat down for dinner in a Greenwich Village tavern. Brady had just founded a national chess magazine. Across the table from him was Bobby Fischer, just a teenager and already a grandmaster of the game. Now, Fischer was never without his pocket chessboard, and as the two men huddled over the dinner table, he pulled it out and began to rehearse for an upcoming match.
His fingers sped by in a blur, and his face showed the slightest of smiles as if in a reverie. He whispered, barely audibly, "Well, if he plays that, I can block his bishop." And then, raising his voice so loud that some of the customers stared, "He wouldn't play that!" I began to weep quietly, aware that in that time-suspended moment, I was in the presence of genius.
But Fischer was a troubled genius who eventually disappeared into a fog of paranoia and hatred and died in exile in Iceland in 2008. Frank Brady is the author of a new book about his old friend. That's his voice you just heard. The book's called Endgame, Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall from America's Brightest Prodigy to the Edge of Madness. And Frank Brady joins me now from our studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You knew Bobby Fischer. First, how did you meet him and what kind of impression did he make on you?
Well, I first heard about him from his chess teacher, Carmine Nigro, and he was telling me that he had this young kid who was really master strength already, and he was just a child. And then I was playing in a tournament on the Upper West Side, and I saw this boy playing. And even in between the rounds lasted about 5 hours for a game, he was playing chess in between the rounds. He couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah, this was in the late 1950s.
Exactly, or maybe mid-50s.
And he just, this was a kid who was unquestionably, clearly special.
There was something special. And I remember some older man kibitzing the game, and Bobby spun around and he said, "Please, this is a chess game." You know, and the man was about 65 years old and he was silenced by this child.
He was 9, 8, 9, 10, 11?
No, he was more like 10 or 11, I think, at that point.
He was an international grandmaster by the age of 15, I should
By the time 15, he had become the youngest international grandmaster in the history of the game.
What was it about the way his mind worked, the way he played the game, that made him so extraordinary?
Well, first of all, he was probably the foremost student of the game. Hmm. He spent 6 to 8 hours every single day studying past games, studying contemporary games. He learned Russian and Serbo-Croat and other languages so that he could follow the games in those newspapers and magazines. And his chess was extremely lucid. It was crystal clear. You knew what he was going to do, but there was no way you could stop it.
Hmm. He sort of drew you in.
Exactly. And it was, if I could make a musical analogy, he was sort of more Bach than Beethoven, more Rembrandt than Rothko. I mean, it was very clear what he was trying to do. There were no secrets. There were no cheap traps.
You just couldn't get out of it.
You couldn't get out of it. He was like, you know, the cobra, and he was going to get you.
Unfortunately, and obviously what some of the things I do want to ask you about are the things that Bobby Fischer became better known for, which was his eccentric behavior. We begin to see him reveal that, and you write about this in the book. His sort of shining, glorious moment was in 1972 when he faces Boris Spassky in the World Championship match. I mean, he's riding high. He is a hero. This is a match that is a Cold War showdown. And yet, he's unsatisfied to some extent.
He's unsatisfied. He wins the World Championship. And yet he despised the publicity he was getting, and he became a recluse. He moved to Los Angeles. He got himself a small basement apartment. He gave no interviews. He played no chess. He became a voracious reader, and he read everything. Sometimes hate literature, unfortunately.
He was, as you say, living in this kind of dump of an apartment in Los Angeles, living off his mother's Social Security checks just a year or two after he was offered millions of dollars in endorsements. At this point, he starts to become more sort of vocal in expressing anti-Jewish sentiments. I mean, do you think that he suffered from a pretty serious psychological condition?
I think he was paranoid. I think he was disturbed. I think he was neurotic. He did not have hallucinations. He did not have total delusions, except if they were touching upon his paranoia. In a sense, it makes him look worse, because if you could say he was mentally ill, you might forgive some of the statements he's made. But I don't think he was what you would call crazy.
The last time many people heard from Bobby Fischer was shortly after the attacks of September 11, 2001. He was in the Philippines at the time, making regular appearances on the radio. And what he said that day, of course, is shocking. It sounds like something you might hear from Charles Manson. I mean, basically saying the United States got what it deserved, and cry, you crybabies, whine, your time is coming. He calls for the death of the president at the time, and again, some anti-Semitic remarks.
I'll tell you that when I heard those statements, and they were on the internet, so I could actually hear them, not only just read them, I personally went ballistic. I was horrified by it, and I didn't want anything to do with Fischer from there on in. I didn't want to honor him in any way. I didn't. But after thinking about it for a number of years, to me it was a little bit like Wagner. You know, can we listen to the music of Wagner, even though he was an anti-Semite and Hitler's favorite composer? Can we separate the man from the art? And that is what I was able to do to enable me, actually. I'd gotten many offers to write a new biography of Fischer, and I had returned them down. And then, until I came to terms with this philosophically.
And Bobby Fischer died in exile in Iceland in 2008. Obviously, you knew him, Frank Brady. How do you think we should remember this very complex legacy of this very complex person?
Well, you know, this is paraphrasing Churchill, he was an enigma inside of a conundrum. Think of him as the greatest chess player that ever lived, the Mozart of chess, if you will, and then think of him also as a failed human being who fell tremendously and quickly and swiftly, fell from grace.
That's Frank Brady. He's the author of Endgame, Bobby Fischer's remarkable rise and fall from America's brightest prodigy to the edge of madness. Frank Brady, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So we're coming up on February and Black History Month, and the jazz bassist Marcus Shelby, whose music you're hearing right now, he seems to know it. His new album is one big meditation on the civil rights movement, and it was just released. And NPR Music's jazz blogger Patrick Jaren-Watanonen is tapping his toes, actually your pen, in the studio next to me, because this is a recording you are very excited about.
Indeed I am. Good to be here, Guy.
I know that a lot of jazz musicians took up the cause of civil rights in the 50s and in the 60s. How does Shelby do it on this record?
Well, in 2011, I would think you would have to do it in a sort of personal way. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially for Marcus Shelby, he was born in 1966, mm-hmm. I believe.
So he was a baby during this era, obviously.
Right. And so as far as the music goes, he approached it in three different ways. There were parts where he writes original music based on historical events like the lynching of Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. There's also music which he interprets from that time period, anything between Curtis Mayfield and Charles Mingus. Oh, wow. And he also goes into spirituals. Spirituals were, of course, an important part of the soundtrack to the civil rights movement, and he arranges them for his large jazz orchestra, like the one we've been listening to. It's called Amen.
That's music from Marcus Shelby. The album is called Soul of the Movement, Meditations on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Patrick, what do you got next?
I want to play a bit from a much smaller band mm-hmm. called Plunge. Its lineup has changed over time, but the one constant is a trombonist named Mark McGrain.
It's like it's almost like a Balkan brass band meets a backup for a beat poet.
Yeah, something like that. It's only three people, trombone, saxophone, and stand-up bass.
And I'm certainly noticing an absence of drums here.
I think that's the idea. This song is called Tin Fish Tango. It's mm-hmm. the name of their new album as well. And for me, listening to this record, I hear that Balkan thing. I also hear a New Orleans thing going on.
Ah, you're right.
Because
right.
you get that low brass and yeah. bass connection. And that makes sense. These guys are from New Orleans.
Yeah, it's not that sort of party music, that kind of Bourbon Street sound that you hear out of New Orleans.
You know, you definitely hear the brass band roots here. There's this other thing. There are these three tracks on this album where the three people just sort of collectively improvise. And there's some unusual structures into how the other pieces are laid out, too. So it's abstracted a little bit from the dance floor, which is very un-New Orleans, but at the same time, you can definitely hear the sort of New Orleans genetic material.
Music from the trio called Plunge off the album Tin Fish Tango. I'm here listening to new jazz releases with NPR Music's jazz blogger Patrick Jaren-Watanonen. Patrick, what else you got for us?
Well, here's another unconventional, kind of a chamber jazz work, in air quotes. This is music by the drummer Paul Motion.
This is absolutely stunning, beautiful music. I think you said the drummer, Paul Motion. I don't hear any drumming here, do I?
I did. These are Paul Motion's compositions. They're scored by a New York-based guitarist named Joel Harrison, but Paul Motion doesn't actually play on this album.
So this is a drummerless band?
Right. If you've ever heard Paul Motion drumming, you really owe it to yourself to check it out if you haven't. Mm. I mean, he's almost 80 now, and it's like the older he gets, it's almost the weirder he gets. Mm. Doesn't like to play straight time a lot, and sort of dances in and outside of the beat. And just as he's kind of a weird drummer, he's kind of a weird composer in a very good way. Lots of fits and starts, and sort of staggers the way he groups notes and rests and pauses. He's also a master of especially ballads, these sort of free-floating, loose, odd time feel, but ultimately really beautiful tunes.
That's Joel Harrison with the music of Paul Motion. Patrick, we have time for just one more recording that you brought in this week.
All right, let's go with a blast from the past.
This sounds so familiar. It's on the tip of my tongue. What am I hearing?
It should. It's the melody of Caravan, which is written by a trombonist in the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Right.
His name is Juan Teasel. This is, of course, not the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Right.
This arrangement comes from an Italian film composer named Piero Umiliani. He's best known for writing the tune Mana Mana of the Muppets
fame. Muppet song.
Mana Mana. Do-do-do-do-do. Mana Mana.
He wrote that.
Mana Mana.
That same guy.
And in 1974, for whatever reason, he wanted to make a Duke Ellington record.
Wow.
This is music that he really enjoyed, so we rounded up a bunch of Italian musicians and recorded it for a jazz label called Oro, H-O-R-O. So enter this new Italian label called Deja Vu, one word, and they contracted with an English DJ impresario type named Giles Peterson, and he went through the whole Oro catalog, and the result is this compilation. It's called Oro, A Jazz Portrait.
Who was that Muppet who sang Mana Mana?
I don't remember, actually.
I don't either. Is all the music on the CD, you know, kind of wacky like this?
Well, I will say this is the most sort of schizo version of this song I've ever heard. I mean, it bounces from really straight-ahead swing to these sort of synthesized beeps and bloops.
And now all I'm doing is picturing Muppets playing the instrument.
You know, if I were to characterize this collection as a whole, there's a little less of that. What I hear most of all, really, is the lasting influence of John Coltrane.
Mm.
So if this was the 1970s, John Coltrane had only been dead for 10 years, not even. And so you hear a lot of his innovations, a lot of the modal jazz exploration on one or two chords, and a lot of the blowing techniques and the way he writes tunes and thinks about grooves and music. Mm.
Some Italian jazz recordings from the 1970s on Oro, A Jazz Portrait. Patrick Jaren-Watanonen is a producer for NPR Music, and you can read more about all of these picks at a blog supreme. That's npr.org/blog supreme. Patrick, thanks again.
Always a pleasure to be here, Guy.
Among the chants and slogans at the demonstrations in Egypt are the words of an early 20th century Tunisian poet named Abdel Kassem al-Shabi. One of his most famous poems has become a rallying cry, both in Egypt and before, in Tunisia. The poem is called To the Tyrants of the World.
Alla ayyuha al-zalim wal-mustabid, habibu al-zalami, adu al-haya, oppressive tyrant, lover of darkness, enemy of life. You have ridiculed the size of the weak people. Your palm is soaked with their blood. You deformed the magic of existence and planted the seeds of sorrow in the fields. Wait, don't be fooled by the spring, the clearness of the sky, or the light of dawn. For on the horizon lies the horror of darkness, rumble of thunder, and blowing of winds. Beware, for below the ash there is fire, and he who grows thorns reaps wounds. Look there, for I have harvested the heads of mankind and the flowers of hope, and I watered the heart of the earth with blood. I soaked it with tears until it was drunk. The river of blood will sweep you, and the fiery storm will devour you.
The poem to the Tyrants of the World, written by the Tunisian poet Abdel Kassem al-Shaabi. In recent weeks, it's become the unofficial rallying cry for millions of Arabs in Egypt and in Tunisia. It was read for us by Ahmed Shihab al-Din. Special thanks to Adel Iskander for the English translation. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Kenya Young and produced by Phil Harrell, Petra Mayer, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Hansi Wong, and Jessica Deal. Our intern is Megan Kane. Michael Kennedy is filling in for Rick Holter as our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz, and remember, you can hear the full version of the program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon. We're back next Sunday with another episode of the Best of Weekends on All Things Considered.